Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is this year's winner of the Tulsa Library Trust and V0 Award for Young Readers Literature. Pam Munoz Ryan is the author of over 40 books for young readers of all ages, from picture books to chapter books to nonfiction readers to her award-winning young adult fiction. Her first major success was in the 90s with Esperanza Rising, a groundbreaking book at the time about a young Latina immigrant settling in a Depression-era California farm camp. Her other major books include Echo, a new Barry honor book, story of three outsiders, one in Nazi Germany, another a Philadelphia orphan, and a Latino girl working on a farm for an interned Japanese-American family who are all connected by a mystical harmonica, and The Dreamer, a story based on Pablo Neruda's early life. She's the winner of numerous awards in her career, and she'll accept the Zero Award, her latest, this Friday evening in a free public event at the Hardesty Regional Library at 7 o'clock, where she'll talk about her life and her writing, as well as sign books. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Pam Munoz Ryan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you for having me.
One of the things I think is really interesting about the numerous books you've written, which I've seen ranging from 25 to 40 in your various bios, you've written books for just about every level of young reader and just about every sort of genre for young reader, from picture books up to very complex young adult novels.
That's correct. I really love changing channels in my mind, and I love, you know, the dichotomy of working in a different format. So I have done picture books for the very young and middle grade novels, young adult novels. But it's challenging for me, but also keeps me sort of fresh and on top of my game.
Even there are sometimes picture books, history books, science books, even a few science, like there's a book about where animals live.
Right.
What sort of motivates you to write a book about science one time and then a young adult novel that almost verges on magic realism on the other?
Well, I think that ideas, it's almost like a confluence of rivers for each book. Some of my stories are based on my family history, like Esperanza Rising is based on my grandmother's immigration story from Aguascalientes, Mexico, to the segregated farm labor camps in the San Joaquin Valley in 1930. So I'm very sentimental about Esperanza Rising, but it was based on my own family's history. The Dreamer, which is the book that I believe that many of the children have been reading for the Zorro Award, you know, was based on a trip that I took to Chile. And after I took this trip, I became very intrigued with the works of Pablo Neruda and his childhood. And so that inspired that book. And sometimes my publisher will solicit a work. They will say, have you ever considered doing a horse story? And when they asked me that, I hadn't, but I also became very intrigued with the idea of it, because horse stories were very much a part of my growing up. As a young girl, I read many of Marguerite Henry's books. And so when they asked me that, it sort of rushed me back to my own childhood and the appeal of those books. And so I did write Paint the Wind. So the ideas come in a variety of forms. And sometimes an idea comes very well formed, and sometimes it takes a very long time for it to develop.
But of course, you're also writing nonfiction from time to time as well, and so
correct.
I assume it's a matter of finding a story you want to share in a new way?
Well, I think I'm very intrigued with little-known stories about historical figures, especially women. And, for instance, in my novel, Writing Freedom, which many children in the United States read in about third or fourth grade, it's based on the true story of Charlotte Parkhurst, who ran away from an orphanage and then in the mid-1800s was trained as a stagecoach driver and posed as a young man in her 20s, was the first woman to vote in a federal election in the United States. So I was very intrigued with this little-known story. And also the same with my nonfiction book, When Marian Sang, about the contralto Marian Anderson, who was the first African-American woman to sing on the stage at the Metropolitan Opera. So I'm very attracted to little-known historical stories. In my novel, Echo, I was entirely smitten with the whole premise of harmonica bands in the 20s and 30s when I found out that indeed in the United States there were over 2,000 elementary and middle school and high school harmonica bands in the U.S. So these little-known parts of history are very intriguing to me.
So let's start with Echo. This is three stories connected by basically our harmonica. And, of course, harmonica bands plays a large role in the second story about Mike. How did you first hear about harmonica bands?
You know, sometimes the story I set out to write is not necessarily the one I end up writing. I was doing research on a completely different idea. I was doing research on the first successful desegregation case in the U.S., Roberto Alvarez versus the trustees of the Lemon Grove School District. And I was out in Lemon Grove, which is a community east of San Diego, going through their 1931 yearbooks. And I came across this photograph of a group of children sitting on the steps of a little country school, each of them holding up a harmonica. And when I asked the docent about it, she said, oh, it doesn't really have anything to do with what you're researching. She was almost trying to turn the page on me, and I said, no, I'm curious. What is it? And she said, well, you know, that was our elementary school harmonica band back in the day, you know, when all the elementary schools had them, you know, during the big harmonica band movement in the United States.
You're going, wait, right. What? What big harmonica movement?
Yeah, and so that, for me, was just like dangling a carrot. I drove home from, you know, half an hour drive home, and all I could think of is, you know, that I prayed that it was true. And I came home and I began researching, and I found out about Hoxie's band in Philadelphia, where, you know, the 62 boy member, you know, band that traveled all over the U.S. and played in Lindbergh's parade and for the Queen of Romania. And I noticed that they also played the same harmonica, the Honer Marine Band, that I saw in the photograph of the children on the steps of the country school. And so I began researching Honer harmonica in the United States, which took me to Honer harmonica in Germany. I called them. They invited me to come. I toured their museum, and that's where I discovered that when Hitler became chancellor in 1933, that in the Honer harmonica factory, they did have young boy apprentices. And so here I had the possibilities for three characters: Friedrich in Germany when Hitler became chancellor, Mike in Pennsylvania in Hoxie's band, which, by the way, was full of orphans during the Depression, and Ivy, a young girl in California in a segregated school. So I had all of these components, and I wanted to imbue the harmonica with some sort of magic, and so I created the original fairy tale that frames or bookends the entire book, and this one harmonica that travels through these three historical periods.
Ivy, you actually used some of the story that you originally began researching, right?
Right. That's right. The story that I thought that I was going to write about that first successful desegregation case in 1931 is referenced in, I think, a two sentences in the book. So it did get its due. It just didn't get as much of a due as I thought it was going to get.
Yeah, and you actually came up with another very interesting story, because Friedrich is... he is in Germany during Hitler's Germany, but he's not deigned to be an ideal German youth. Why do that?
There's a saying, you know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Yeah.
And I really like, I'm always interested in having a different angle on stories that people often know about. So I wanted it to be from the perspective of a young German boy who... did not want to be involved in Hitler Youth, who came from a family that was very free-thinking, very independent, which, of course, was very looked down upon during Hitler's Germany. That's when many intellectuals left Germany in these early years before the war, when he was chancellor. And so I just loved the different angle and the different take, because I found that interesting, so I thought that others would find it interesting, too.
And of course, Ivy has a connection to another shameful incident during World War II, and that is her family is caretaking for a family that have been internees, yes. Japanese-American internees.
Yes, that's something else I found out while I was researching that time period. I found out that there were many American farmers who had, for many years, been friends and neighbors with many Japanese farmers who had been in the U.S. for lengthy amount of time, and when their neighbors were interred, took over their farms, worked their farms, paid their mortgages so that they would not lose their farms. Of course, it didn't happen to the great majority, but when I discovered that there was that effort, that there were those people who st- stepped up and said, we've known this family for all these years, and you know, we want to help them. So when I found out about that, I wanted to portray it in some way and to show that there were instances of that, you know, one person helping the other.
Altruism, yeah. Yeah. My thinking would be that was just a situation ripe to be exploited, where somebody would basically take over the land at rock bottom prices for basically paying taxes and things like that.
Right.
A lot of wealth exchanged.
Right. And what happened in most cases is the banks just took them over completely. You know, the bills couldn't be paid, and people, you know, the farms went to the bank.
Yeah.
And then were resold at a very low price to whoever wanted to purchase them.
This is one of your most recent novels, right? Echo.
Correct.
Echo is
yes.
perhaps the last main novel you've done?
It is. I'm currently sort of in writing mode here.
Uh-huh.
I'm under contract for 3 more novels, so I'm on a list schedule and working away. And Echo is by far my lengthiest. It was
yes.
Over 500 pages, and it took about 6 years. So mostly because it is historical fiction, and there was so much research involved.
My guest today is Pam Munoz-Ryan, who's a writer of books of all types for children of all ages, young adults, from earliest readers, chapter books, science and history books, picture books, and she is the winner of the Tulsa Library Trust 2018 and the Zero Award for Young Readers Literature. She'll receive the award and speak about her books this Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the Hardesty Regional Library, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, who was it that first encouraged you to begin writing?
Well, I didn't come from a curriculum in school like children today, meaning that when I was in elementary school, we didn't write across the curriculum or have young authors visit our schools or have family literature nights or any of those types of things. I think I would have loved all of that because I was very hooked on books at a very young age. I came from a very blue-collar family. You know, my dad drove a delivery truck in Bakersfield, California, and my mom worked as a clerk at a high school. So as much as I loved books and knew that I wanted to have a career that had something to do with books, I also knew that whatever career I chose would have to have be something that had a paycheck and could pay the bills. And also, to be honest with you, writing or being a writer was never really presented to me as like a job you could have when you grew up. I always thought that I would become a teacher or work in a bookstore or work in a library. And I did become a teacher. And after I worked a number of years in teaching, or 5 years in teaching, I married and had my children and stayed home with my children and then went back to school to get my master's degree, thinking that I would teach children's literature in college, because I still had this, I still had this feeling that there was something yet to be discovered about myself that had to do with writing or books or being with books. So I thought, well, maybe this would be being a professor of children's literature. So on that route, I finished my master's, and one of my professors sat me down one day and asked me if I'd ever considered doing any professional writing. And when I told her no, she encouraged me. And she planted a seed that wouldn't stop growing. And from the moment she said that, I just couldn't stop thinking about the idea of writing my own stories.
What was it that made her suggest that? Had you done some writing?
What happened was she admitted to me that in the department, there was a number of professors in the particular education department, and she said that when I turned in my papers, that they passed them around to read. So for whatever reason, she just felt like that I had some aptitude there, and it was the first time that anyone had ever told me that. And I think sometimes as teachers or as supervisors or of any kind, we forget how those positive comments, how somebody carries those in their heart.
Now, probably when you first started writing, there, you know, one of the things that's very apparent about your work is you're writing about people who, say, a generation ago, people weren't writing books about, you know, the kid in the trailer park, someone like Charlotte Parkhurst, or, the story of your own family, like Esperanza Rising, a mm-hmm. diaspora story, if you will. Was that a powerful influence for you?
Well, first of all, Esperanza Rising will be having its 20th anniversary
yeah.
in a year. So it has been in print for almost 20 years. You're right, there weren't a lot of books about immigration stories. And, I mean, I even remember my editor and I talking and thinking that, well, she loved the story and I loved writing the story. And we actually had a moment of wondering, well, maybe it would be a really nice regional book. You know, maybe in the Southwest it would be very popular, but we had no idea.
But it wouldn't play in North Dakota or so. You know, this is the attitudes of publishers at that point, I guess.
Well, now it is Common Core all over the United States. So, and in a number of countries, it's been translated into many languages. So in the United States, and it is on the menu for every show. I just came home from North Dakota 2 days ago from a reading conference where teachers came up to me at, you know, every few moments and said, I use this every year in my class. I read Esperanza Rising. So when 20 years ago, though, when I wrote the book and when my publisher endorsed it and published it, we did not have a clue. You know, you don't really know the journey the book is going to take. You write it. You hope that you're writing the best book that you can write. You put your heart and soul into it, and then you sort of give it a hug and send it out to the world, and you really don't know, you know, where it's going to go.
You said this is a true story, or at least inspired by a true story of how your grandmother...
Right, it is historical fiction, yeah. And it parallels my grandmother's immigration story very closely from Aguascalientes to the camps in California.
So she was literally forced out of Mexico because of familial,
right?
I guess in the story, Esperanza's mother, his father is killed, I guess, and the brother is going to marry her, and they have to, they leave to go to the United States. Unfortunately, it's the Great Depression, and so they're living in what Californians called Okie camps,
right?
Which was places for people who left the Dust Bowl, left Mexico.
Right.
And tried to work
and
as agricultural.
The camps were all segregated.
Yeah.
You know, and my mother was born in the Mexican camp. On my mother's birth certificate, on the line that is reserved for the name of a hospital, are the words DeGiorgio Farms.
Wow.
So, interestingly, my father, my dad, the man who raised me, was from Chakota, Oklahoma, and he came when he was 6 years old to California, and he also worked in the same camps. He was an Oklahoma boy. He was an Okie, and he worked driving trucks, moving the Mexicans from the camp out to the fields, back and forth and back and forth. But he didn't meet my mother until many, many years later when they were much older and, you know, in their young 20s or 30s in town. But they both, at various times, worked in the camps.
Now, the man you say who raised you as your child,
right.
Donald
right.
Bell,
uh-huh.
That was your name for a while. Now you began using Munoz. Why was
right.
that?
Well, that was really a decision when I, way back when I first started writing 30 years ago, my agent suggested that I use my mom's name, my mom's maiden name, and my family name, because I was writing Esperanza Rising. Mm-hmm. I was also writing some other picture book manuscripts like Mice and Beans and Nacho and Lolita. And she just thought that it would be a wise move. And I was also very proud of my Mexican heritage. And that was really the only reason to use Pam Munoz. Ryan is my married name.
Now, let's talk about a couple of the other books. You mentioned The Dreamer earlier, which is a story based on Pablo Neruda. You said you were going to Chile and I guess was learning about Pablo Neruda, or what exactly?
Well, I mean, I had read Neruda as early as high school, and I was invited to Chile by the Ministry of Education to speak at some international schools. And so before I went, I brushed up on some Neruda and Mistral and the early works of Isabel Allende, since I was visiting their homeland. And while I was there, I visited several of Neruda's homes, two of his homes. And after my return from Chile, I was at a conference with another author and illustrator, John Muth, telling him about my trip. And he was telling me about a story from Neruda's childhood about Neruda passing a gift to an unknown child through a hole in the fence. And I was so intrigued about this story that after this conference, I came home and found the essay that Neruda wrote called The Gift, and that was all it took for this whole idea to plant itself and relentlessly hold on. And plus, I had come home from Chile just enamored and, you know, very sentimental about my trip there. And so the book is about Neftali Reyes. That was Neruda's childhood name and his birth name. And he, his childhood is just, you know, very dramatic. He was painfully shy to the point that he has physical reactions when he had to confront people. He was embarrassed by an impediment, a stuttering impediment, and he was desperate to please his dictatorial and sometimes cruel father. And so there were all these really interesting components, and it's sort of how he made order out of chaos and how he overcame all of this and became, you know, who many people believe is, you know, one of the most popular poets of the 20th century.
You mentioned another book that you wrote earlier, which was Writing Freedom, about Charlotte Parkhurst. And I guess this was just coming in contact with her story of, you know, leading this sort of double life where she wanted to work with horses and become a stagecoach driver and couldn't do that as a woman, so she did it as a man.
Right. And also that came about because, you know, like I mentioned before, sometimes the book you set out to write becomes something else, but also very often one book leads to another. I was doing a picture book on the state of California. And in my research, in, you know, historical research, I came across these Wells Fargo documents. And I came across articles that were printed in the San Francisco newspaper about One-Eyed Charlie, who was Charlotte Parkhurst. And so after I finished the picture book on California, I started researching Charlotte Parkhurst's life and was entirely intrigued. And, you know, so much of her life was because of society at the time. She was born in a poorhouse. It was during a time when girls could not travel alone. And she, in order to survive, she posed as a boy so that she could run away. And she was ultimately hired on the East Coast as a stable boy and then recruited, after she learned how to drive stages on the East Coast, was recruited to the California Stage Lines in 1849 to drive stages all up and down the Pacific coast. And this was even after she lost the sight in one eye. And that was why the newspaper article was written about her in San Francisco. So it was just such a great story, and writing about her young life and finding her birth records and voting records, it was just very, very intriguing. And like I said, one book just sort of led to another.
Yeah. Now, one of the things your books seem to do, and I assume it's you get an idea and you write, but it seems like you're very much attracted to underdogs. I mean, a lot of writers are, but you're also writing about people in which probably up until recently, most people wouldn't write about.
Well, there are a lot of social justice issues in my books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very drawn to, you know, strong, independent women or characters who did things, who defied society's norms. But I'm not quite sure why I'm attracted to all of that. But and it's not in every single one of my books, but I do seem to have a penchant for it.
Now, are you currently writing novels? Or are you still doing the occasional picture book or chapter books? I know this is something I, again, from the start of our conversation, I'm really impressed by the fact that you try to move around and write for a lot of different ages. And chapter books have been a big part of your writing over your history.
Right. Well, right now I'm under contract for 3 more novels, but I have the Tony Baloney chapter book series. And this is, you know, a very fun story about a little boy penguin named Tony Baloney, who's very beleaguered because he's the only boy in a family of all girls. And the tag on Tony Baloney is Tony Baloney does not love trouble, but trouble loves him. And so, you know, so I'm doing that very fun, light-hearted project that has, I would say a light-hearted project, but has a lot of heart in it. And I still do the Tony Baloney chapter books, especially intermittently with the novels, because the novels take a lot longer to edit. So if I send something to my editor, it might take 3 or 4 weeks to get it, you know, to get a big rewrite back. In the meantime, I can work on Tony Baloney.
Now, it sounds like research is a big part of any novel that you take on. You mentioned in Echo, you actually went to the Hohner harmonica factory in Germany. you know, you went to look at archives in Southern California for the story about the desegregation case. Is that just a normal part of your working way?
Well, I would say, first of all, research, even if you're writing fiction, is always a part of what you're doing.
Sure.
It's sort of ongoing. I went to Chile for, you know, and that whole experience inspired The Dreamer. I went to Oaxaca when I was researching The Night of the Radishes, which is in my novel, Becoming Naomi Leon. And I would say that if there's some place I can go and I can afford to do it, it certainly has panned out to be worth it in the long run. If I hadn't gone to the Hohner Harmonica Factory in Trossingen, in Germany, I would have never known. I would have never discovered that there were young boy apprentices that had, you know, worked in the factory when Hitler was chancellor. I would have never seen the cases in the museum of the, you know, well-loved and long-carried harmonicas and the letters that people had written about them. And that was where I got the idea for the denouement for the climax of the book. So the research has so far paid off.
It sounds like it just helps you seep in the life of where your character may be going.
Right. I mean, it gives you details that you would have not normally had by just reading or Googling it's very enriching. And, you know, sometimes I'm writing about a place I might not have been, but for instance, in Paint the Window, I did the horseback ride that is in the book in southwestern Wyoming. So I do try to bring some of the original flavor, you know, that to each of my novels.
All right. Well, we wish you great success and congratulations on the Anne Wiesner Award. It's
thank
much
you.
Deserved.
It's an honor.
Much deserved. And Pam, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Writer Pam Munoz-Reinen speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is this year's winner of the Tulsa Library Trust's 2018 Anne Wiesner Award for Young Readers Literature. She'll be receiving the award and speaking about her books and signing books this Friday evening at 7 o'clock in a free event at the Hardesty Regional Library. You can learn more at tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.